Welcome to Red Inca. I'm Jared Kimber. This week on Red Inca, we talk to one of the greatest to ever do it.
Susanna Wilson Bates, but more commonly known as Susie Bates in the cricketing world. And I am a professional cricketer, which I love saying, considering a lot of my cricket career was amateur and part-time, so full-time professional cricketer.
We talk about LeBron James, Diana Taurasi, being a point guard, cricket over basketball, amateurism, the evolution of the women's game, professionalism, chasing, struggling with England, opening the batting, and how it feels to never play a test. I can't believe you didn't mention your sponsor there. It's on your shirt and no one's going to see it now. I want to start with basketball a little bit because obviously you played both sports as a kid when you were coming up. My big question is, and I spent hours trying to find footage of Susie Bates playing basketball, and all I saw was like 7 and 12 second clips. And there was one thing where you were, I think you were playing for the Scorchers or something, and you were playing a 2-on-2 game against a couple of professional basketballers. All I could find is that you were a guard. Were you a point guard? Were you a two guard? Were you a slasher? Were you a chucker? Were you a floor general? I need to know full details, Susie, of what kind of basketball you were.
It was before women's sport was put on television, so that's why it'll be hard to find. I was a point guard at heart. I loved running the floor and getting the ball down the court and setting up my teammates. But when I got to the higher international level, I became more of a two guard because my pace wasn't quite quick enough to match the international guard. So, yeah, like I was a 1-2-3 guard. In New Zealand, could get away with being a 3 guard, almost a small forward. But internationally, I was very short, which cricketers find hard to believe.
Yeah, I was going to say, it was funny. When I looked up your height, I actually thought you were even taller than you were. And it's probably because of the amount of times I've seen you standing next to 5-foot-tall wicketkeepers rather than anything else. I'm really happy that you're a point guard at heart because I'm pretty sure that I've written before that you captained a little bit like a point guard. So I'm glad that I didn't get that one wrong when I was guessing. Your basketball goes off. You end up, playing for New Zealand in the Olympics, and you've got all these incredible stories of being around these professional athletes like Kobe Bryant and LeBron James and everything. How hard was it then to turn your back on basketball and go back towards cricket?
Yeah, just like it's hard to say, but it was literally just a little bit of luck that I turned my back on basketball. During high school, I loved all sports, but cricket and basketball were the sports that I was getting picked for representative teams. And when I left high school, there was the thought of going to college in America, but I got picked for the White Ferns that summer, so that sort of held me back, and I loved playing international cricket. And then the coach at the time, Steve Jenkins, was really supportive of me playing both sports because we didn't have contracts in those days. And I think he felt if at that time he made me make a decision that I might have gone towards basketball. So he was really supportive. Basketball probably were less supportive. It was like there's enough players, we don't need you. So I felt like I had to commit a little bit more to my basketball, and then went to Christchurch when I was 19 to train with a team that was playing in the Australian Professional League at the time. And I sort of gave cricket away for almost 12 months. I tried to play club cricket here and there and still do a little bit of training, but basketball was the focus, and then managed to sort of scrape my way into that Olympic side. I was on the fringe for a lot of the 18 months, and the team went to Europe just before the Olympics, and I missed out on that team, and I thought that was probably my chance gone. But I trained really hard, and that while the girls were away, and I sort of made the final 12 for the Olympics. And when I got to the Olympics, just playing at that level against, we played the USA, China, watching the Dream Team play live, I had the bug for basketball, and I was finding any way to play basketball. I'd signed with the Christchurch team in the Australian League the following season, but that team unfortunately just folded, so I was sort of left on a limb of what to do. I had taken a break from my study, and it was summer, so I ended up going to Sydney to try and play with the Sydney Uni team, ended up playing club cricket for the Sydney side, which was stacked with Alex Blackwell, Lisa Slaker, Kate Blackwell, Leah Poulton, Aaron Byrne. So we had a club side that I dabbled in, but was there to play basketball.
Ridiculous.
But that 2009 World Cup, without any basketball taking off for me, I decided I'd play domestic cricket again. And it, yeah, sort of fell into that path again. But if it had have been different with some basketball pathways, I felt like after the Olympics, I was wanting to play more and more basketball, but opportunities sort of fell away. And then I went to the World Cup, and playing in a World Cup for New Zealand, I sort of got that bug back. So yeah, it wasn't really by choice necessarily, which yeah, it just sort of happened that way. And it felt like I was just looking for the next opportunity, whatever that happened to be.
Did you, when you played the US women's team, did you have to guard Sue Bird or Diana Taurasi?
I did. Diana Taurasi, who I felt like I had my arm up in her face and she could just shoot over me or blow by me. So we decided to play quite aggressive, and I'll never forget, we're at the free throw line after someone had made another foul, trying to stop someone from scoring or dunking on us, and one of the players was like, "You guys, it's not rugby." that was the only way we could compete. So trying to get a little bit physical. We were outnumbered in terms of size, any team we played at the Olympics. But yeah, it was pretty cool to play those players who, they were the only female athletes I'd really seen on TV, was the WNBA players.
Yeah, yeah. I think Lisa Leslie was in that side too, wasn't she? So, I mean, it was a pretty stacked team to go up against, wasn't it? And then also you have the men's side there as well, which, you know, in the Olympics, they're always the biggest draw when it comes to celebrity of any team. And if you grew up as a basketball fan and LeBron and Dwayne Wade and Kobe are all there, are you hanging out with them? Are you watching them from a distance? What's the story?
Yeah, so they're that famous that they can't even stay in the village. So there's certain athletes that tend to stay out of the village just because it's not just, you know, the general population, it's athletes that want photos with them. And so I remember they'd come into the village occasionally and they'd sort of be the basketball girls going, "Oh, Chris Bosh and Jason Kidd are in the lunch hall," and then you'd go out and try and find them. So throughout the tournament, you know, the females played one day and the males played the next day. So we would go and watch a few of the games, and just watching them live was like special for me. And then just, I don't even know how it happened, we had some quite forward females in our team that made friends with the USA security guards on the final, and we ended up going on their team bus to their after party on the last night, which, like, I still pinch myself when I talk about it because it seems so surreal. But we got to meet LeBron James, Kobe Bryant, Dwayne Wade. And what annoys me sometimes was the cricket girls, and now especially the younger cricket girls, they're like, who's that? And I'm like, I'm like, you know, trying to flex with some of the younger girls. Like, yeah, I've met Jason Kidd, Dwayne Wade. They're like, oh yeah, cool. but yeah, it was just, I don't know how we got ourselves in that situation, but yeah, it was an unreal experience to kind of, at 19 years old, to sort of meet the people that I'd only watched on TV and were like the superstars of sport in my eyes. I grew up watching Michael Jordan with my brother, so the NBA was like the big deal, and yeah, it was pretty cool.
Have you met, this is just a random question, but have you met Virat Kohli before? I'm assuming you have.
Because
if you say LeBron and Virat Kohli, surely like dinner party openers, that would be quite a starter in almost anywhere,
like,
right? You've got to hook that up somehow.
He's like been around, but not like, "Hi, Virat, I'm Susie."
One of the reasons I'm talking about the basketball is, other than the fact that obviously you are very talented to be able to, you know, represent New Zealand in two different in sports, but the other thing that I'm really interested in is, you're watching the WNBA players who are professional, right? You're talking about, you know, potentially playing professional basketball, you know, the Australian Women's League was quite strong at that time. There would have been opportunities perhaps to go and play in China as you got a little bit older, and obviously Russia and all these other places where women's basketball is quite big. Cricket, at that stage, women's cricket is really amateur when you are coming through. Do you notice the difference? Is there anything in your head going, well, if I stick with one, there's maybe a career, and if I stick with the other one, I'm just playing a pastime? Or is it doesn't even really occur to you for that to be the case?
Yeah, it's interesting because when you're in it, you're not really thinking like that. But now that I look back, I sort of felt like I just played what I loved. So when I first made the New Zealand cricket team, I remember looking around the field and, you know, I'd played cricket at domestic level, but international level, the fielders that were either side of me, I was like, whoa, these guys are good. And playing at that level, I just had another level of enjoyment of the game of cricket. And then the same with basketball, like the more competitive it got, whether I was playing in the Australian League or training with the Tall Ferns, I just loved that side of, you know, playing against really good people and training with really good people. And I think looking back, it wasn't even an option for me to be a professional. Like, it didn't really cross my mind that I'm going to be a professional athlete. I was studying for Z School and I was thinking about being a PE teacher, but these other sporting opportunities were coming up and I was just taking them, and I was living at home while I was studying, so I didn't have to earn a living, and I was able to do part-time jobs. So it was never about making money. It was just like, oh, there's this tournament coming up, or there was the Olympics and there was a World Cup. And I think what kept me in cricket was never about the money. There was just always a clear pathway in New Zealand. We went to World Cups every 4 years. It was always funded. There was a program tour guaranteed, so I could plan out the year and know this was coming up, then a World Cup followed. Whereas with basketball, unfortunately, in New Zealand, it was a four-year cycle, and 12 months from the Olympics, they sort of started to build up a program. And that, I think, how I functioned wasn't quite enough. So I sort of was like, oh, here's cricket. If I do this, then I can go to the World Cup. And it kept me almost entertained. And then basketball sort of fell away, and I had to be out of New Zealand, I felt, to make it. And for whatever reason, I don't know if that was a conscious decision, I just had enough in cricket that was keeping me motivated. And yeah, I honestly thought at the 2017 World Cup that I was going to have to give it away, because, you know, it almost wasn't sustainable in terms of what we were earning. And I felt like I'd done a lot of it, and then everything, a franchise comp came up, and I was like, oh yeah, I want to be a part of that. And then another World Cup, and then another franchise tournament came up, and it just honestly, yeah, an opportunity kept coming that I wanted to be a part of, and that's probably why I'm still here.
So that was 2017. At that stage, you were like one of the best players in the world, and you were looking at retiring, right? And you're saying that, I mean, if you look at women's cricket, that's quite common, right? Women get between, you know, 28 to 30. They've been, especially the uber talented players like you, they start playing at a very young age, and then they move on to other careers quite often at that point. So were you particularly close to giving it up, or is it more a situation of you were thinking about it and then suddenly things happened where that just disappeared anyway?
Yeah, I think it felt kind of a natural, after each four-year cycle, it was sort of like you've reassessed. And I was captain at the time, and that came with other, I guess, pressure and stresses, and I wasn't always enjoying all the off-field stuff that came with that. So my enjoyment level wasn't as high as I felt it should be. So there were those factors. And, yeah, it was all the players before me. You know, we weren't earning, you know, money that was actually sustainable, and lots of, you know, the captains I played under finished at 27, 28 because they had to either think about their career, think about a family and all those sort of things, which cricket didn't really support. So yeah, I feel really fortunate that at 36, like, there was no way 10 years ago that a 36-year-old could pretend, well, sorry, in the way the game is now, it's very different, but they had to give it away because of the sacrifices they'd made. So, yeah, I was sort of seeing the best of both worlds in terms of the professionalization of the game. And, I don't know. I feel like maybe I was just being irrational, but at the time it felt realistic that I was going to have to maybe step away and do something else just in terms of financially supporting myself.
Cricket 8 brings you this show. They are a new player in the game trying to educate fans on what is really happening in cricket. Head over for their watch-alongs, podcasts and articles on what is happening on the field and why it matters. Cricket 8 is your place for cricket intelligence. 2006, you make your debut. How amateur was it at that stage? Was there match fees? Was there, you know, were they making, they probably weren't making you pay for your blazers like the women before had to do. So what level of amateur are we sort of talking about at that point?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's hard not to compare where it is now, but I compare it to other women's sports in New Zealand. And so to me, it felt I wasn't paying for anything, you know, like my trips were paid for, my accommodation was paid for, my flight. So I was an 18-year-old living at home, so like I didn't have any costs anyway. So it didn't feel amateur. It felt like a real privilege that all this stuff was given to you for free at that time. But yeah, we went away. We got it was something silly, like if you lived at home, you got $30 a day. And if you lived away from home because you had a mortgage, you got $70. So that was a disadvantage being at home. But yeah, like all the girls either were studying, like young and studying, or had other careers. We had police officers, teachers, we had a vet. So that it was sort of like a hobby. Now looking back, you trained during the winter, you played a short stint of domestic cricket, and there was probably a home tour and away tour if you were lucky, and then every 4 years a World Cup. So the schedule wasn't that demanding, but the girls trained, you know, as professional as they could with what they were doing. So yeah, $30 a day. I probably saved up and went to Subway, so I saved more money at the time. It went a lot further, $30 a day back then too.
Yeah. When did you realize that it might, that professionalism might be coming in? Because, you know, in New Zealand, it takes a little bit longer, but in England, is it 2013, 2014, 2012? I know it's somewhere around there. When it starts, are you looking at England and other countries and thinking, well, we might be a chance of becoming professionals here as well? Or you, is it just, that's just separate to the way that you're thinking about things?
Yeah, I think, honestly, because that was never an option in my head of why I played, it didn't actually cross my mind. Like, I think if I'd set out to be a professional cricketer and I was seeing it unfold in Australia and England and how it was here, I might have seen that differently. But because I just loved playing and I was never thinking it was going to be professional, everything I got at a time felt like a bonus. Which, yeah, looking back, then the first contract I got technically for the White Ferns, they gave out four contracts to players, but we were like signed as women's development officers in our region. So I think we got 30 odd thousand to be the women's cricket development officer, but they would let us be available for all White Ferns things. But we were literally had a full-time job as well as playing for the White Ferns. So, you know, but at the time I was so grateful for this opportunity to be able to do my sport and be supported. So, yeah, and I hate that now that looking back, you felt like you're grateful for anything. And then we probably got to a point that we realized we should be demanding more, and we have demanded more. But yeah, at the time I was like, wow, this is what I love, and I'm getting paid to do it a little bit. And I don't have to get another job just yet. And it kind of just got bigger and bigger and bigger, and yeah, I don't even know how it happened, really, just sort of in it. And then you're like, oh, this is pretty good gig for 12 months, I'll sign there, and yeah, I'll keep playing.
Did you notice an improvement in your game when you became professional compared to when you were amateur? I mean, I remember talking to some of the coaches of women's cricket, and they were saying that they could see the difference in just in the nets, because suddenly everyone was hitting the ball harder because they were doing proper gym work, and, you know, everyone was looking after their core correctly, and, you know, there was range hitting, all the things that women cricketers didn't have time for before because they had to do their full-time jobs, rush to the gym for half an hour and then go to a net session, right? So they saw it, but did you feel different things changing in your game that you didn't have access to before?
Yeah, what's funny about that is I feel like I've trained the same way. And so in my mind, probably since, if I'm honest, probably since I was 20, like the first couple of years, I didn't really know what it took. Yeah, I feel like I've obviously learned a lot, and but I've trained just as hard, but all of a sudden it's like I'm doing the same job that I've always done and my income's 10 times bigger. So I find that fascinating because I guess through basketball, I probably learned the fitness side of things really impacted your game, you know, like, and there was lots of testing. And so the fitter I got, the better I could play. It was a real direct correlation. I think sometimes in cricket, that can be hidden when earlier in your career because it's not as physically demanding because we don't play test match cricket. And so I always felt like I trained like a full-time athlete, and I was in a position where I was a student living at home. So my work was around my training, and Chris Donaldson, who's now the Black Caps trainer, was a trainer in Dunedin, and he just joined me in with the boys. So I was doing a strength and conditioning program as an amateur, not being paid to do it just because I wanted to get better, just the same as, and now he's actually doing the White Ferns programming. So yeah, but what I felt was I was training like a professional even though I wasn't being paid, but I was competing with amateurs, and then all of a sudden that shifted where everyone was training a lot more. So the standard, the depth all around the world, you could see that changing, whereas I sort of felt like I was behaving like a full-time athlete without getting paid, and then the others started to get paid so they could train like that.
So you noticed everyone else sort of catching up then more than
well,
you
it wasn't
changing.
So much catching up. It's just I felt like I was able to give myself the best chance with the people and the resources that were around me, whether I was getting paid. But older players or players in other countries that didn't have that, you know, it was sort of by choice how hard you trained, whereas then you get contracts and then people tell you how much you have to train.
So that obviously changes the overall quality of women's cricket quite quickly. And the other thing that comes off the back of that is franchise cricket, right? It's, you know, New Zealand's a small place. You're a big star in New Zealand. You're going to be in the side automatically. Franchise cricket is a little bit more paying for your supper. And, you know, you chose cricket because you loved it. As you said before, this is something that you love to do. It becomes a job at a certain point, especially when you're a franchise cricketer and you're playing in some random league and you don't want to be there and the hotel's not as nice as you were hoping it was going to be. And, you know, you can't get your phone to work properly and you've got to go to training again and then you're on a flight the next morning, all those sorts of things. What is it like becoming a professional at that stage, knowing that you are, you know, it is more of a job and a career than it is a hobby, as you discussed it before, a hobby that you chose?
Yeah, I feel like there's a real shift in my mentality, and probably for a year or two. So I had this freedom when I was a young athlete. If I wanted to go to that basketball tournament, I hadn't signed a contract. So if I was like, I'm going to this basketball tournament, and it was sort of up to them if they picked me or not, they couldn't actually say no. Or if I wanted to train for 12 months to make the Olympic side, no one could tell me. I could kind of go, okay, I want to play in this, so I'm going to train, and then I'll shift to that. And I dictated my program. And then obviously when you sign a contract, I felt with basketball I couldn't do that. I had to go to cricket training. So naturally basketball fell away. And then, yeah, I think it is the mentality of now you have to do it, whereas I always trained, I need to get better, so I'm going to hit X amount, you know, 6 days a week or whatever it was, or I need to get better, so I'm going to run and I'm going to gym and I'm going to tap into this coach because I think they're really good. And I sort of had this freedom of my own program. And then it was sort of other people telling me what to do. And I was a little bit like, oh, this is different. And that took a bit of adjusting. And in terms of the franchise stuff, I don't know. I've always found that really invigorating because, you know, I played for Otago in New Zealand for so many years, and that was what I did. That these franchise tournaments, it's always like really refreshing for someone who's been doing it for so long. And yeah, you get, I guess, in some phases where you get a bit homesick or you're not around your people, but, you know, like I always feel like this is, I would never have dreamt of these situations. And I know as well, I'm at the stage where it's coming to an end. So I feel like once it started, it's now I, you know, I'm not like people who have another 10, 15 years of this constant cricket treadmill. I'm kind of like, you know, this is getting near the end, make the most of every opportunity. So I've never...
I still like an adventure for you because it's a new thing that you're doing, right? Rather than maybe if you've been doing it for 15 years, it would be
different. Yeah, the teams are new, the coaches are new, and like the tournaments are quite new still. And like I say, it's coming to an end, so you're sort of more appreciative, I think. Whereas someone like Mealy, it's kind of like picking and choosing, because if she plays everything for her whole career, she's never going to see any of her people.
I want to ask you a little bit about batting and everything. As the women's game has got more professional, you know, generally bowlers are more, usually the more athletic players. So fitness and training and professionalism and cricket now, getting athletes away from other sports because there is a financial reason to play for it. Have you noticed the bowling going to a different level during your career from where you started in 2006 till now?
Yeah, I think just on average, every pace bowler is a lot quicker. It's interesting though, because I still think back to Catherine Fitzpatrick, who I played against once, and she was as quick as anyone that I've faced.
Yeah.
But she was kind of out on a limb, and then everyone else was 10, 15k slower, whereas you play in the WBBL, and any opening fast bowler, you know, is above 115, you know, whereas that was kind of the top. And then, you know, you had doubly medium paces bowling at 100k. There was a lot of, well, less than 100k, a lot of them. Yeah, so just the athleticism of all the domestic players, especially in Australia and England. So whenever you now play in the 100 or WBBL, every fast bowler gets the ball through. There's none of that along the wicket bowling that we perhaps had occasionally. Yeah, and I feel like there's going to be a couple of young players that, you know, really max out their potential because they're going to have been in a fast bowling system since the age of 15. But we haven't, you know, the systems haven't been in place quite long enough, but you'll have females hit that 130 mark because they've actually trained to be that type of player. Whereas it was sort of, if they had fast twitch bowlers and bowled fast, it was a little bit that, was more a natural ability rather than a trained thing.
And as someone, as you said, you know, there was a lot of bowlers that were bowling. Yeah. When I first started watching women's cricket around what, 90, 95, you know, 100, 105 pace, you're now facing 115, 120, 125, you know, Hashem is maybe quicker again on occasion. How does that change for your batting? Because it's almost a different sport to what you began with to where you are now. I know you would have faced a lot of men, so it's not that the extra pace is necessarily something that is shocking to you. But at the same time, it's very different to suddenly have an attack where there are two and three women who are bowling like that. Did you have to evolve with the game from a batting perspective?
I'd like to think so, but yeah, I feel like, you know, for a long time, in a lot of the cricket I played, you could be a bit of a front foot bully. So you could bank on, you know, 80 to 90% of the deliveries in some of the cricket you were playing that you could play off the front foot. Even if it was back of a length, you could almost front foot pull, whereas, you know, that's not the case. You know, England, just in the last series, they use the bouncer extremely well, and it's at your head and it's good pace. So, yeah, I guess it's not necessarily change the way you've trained, because the bowlers you're facing are getting quicker, so you're kind of just naturally getting acclimatized to that everywhere you go. But yeah, you can no longer, and that was probably my strength when I first came on the scene as a young 18-year-old. I sort of held the bat high up the handle and had long levers, and I just stepped down the wicket and swung. But now those balls heavier on the bat, and you know, bowlers having variations, it's changed so much. And I probably haven't even really thought about it that much until now, but that with my batting style and where I access different areas of the ground has changed just through the nature of the bowling.
Well, I mean, you're batting because you are taller than a lot of women's cricketers. You were that sort of Matthew Hayden, big step down sort of player. And as the game has changed, you know, a lot of tall batters have trouble with short balls, right? And that would have been something that probably would have come to you much later in your career, because that's when people started bowling the multiple of short balls. So you've been playing for, you know, almost 20 years in professional cricket. But in terms of, compared to a lot of other professionals in the game, you've actually probably batted through two entirely different eras of the sport. So you had to be successful in one era and then change to the other one. But as you said, a professional doesn't really notice that, because one day someone turns up to the nets and she's a bit quicker, and the next day you're in the game and there's two quicks rather than one quick. And it's just a natural thing that you're always staying one step ahead. But it is interesting that your technique has to change a little bit, because you can't pop on the front foot to, you know, to some of the quicks around the world.
Yeah, and I remember I had a really high grip, and so if I did get a short ball, I remember there was this phase of my career where I'd sort of roll my bottom hand because I was so high on the bat, but that ball was very few and far between. So it wasn't like a massive weakness. But yeah, it is fascinating. And I think with 2020 cricket as well, just naturally the shots that you feel like you bring into your game. Whereas, you know, probably in the first 10 years of my career, didn't play a lap. You know what I mean? Like that, when I think about that and the young girls playing for the Sparks and the coach, if there's no 45, he's encouraging them to lap. You know, that's what they do. Whereas for 10 years, I could play successfully without that shot or a reverse lap. But yeah, it is kind of fascinating when you think about the evolution of a game like that and how different it is for players coming into it.
So I interviewed Nicholas Perrone a couple of years ago. So he basically didn't play any first-class cricket. So obviously when he was a kid, he played a lot of red ball cricket. He then had a car accident, had a falling out with Trinidad, and doesn't play first-class cricket for them. And he ends up at a barbecue with, you know, I think it was at Dwayne Bravo's house or something like that. And it's all the Trini boys are around. And he says, can I make it to the top level without having played first class cricket? Like, will I develop the right way? And I've been thinking about that quite a lot recently. And obviously Nicholas Perrin's done, you know, spoiler alert, he's done okay. But I've been thinking of that a lot with your game and a few of the other women who haven't played test cricket. You would have played a lot of red ball cricket in your career, right? So it's not as if you never faced a red ball when you were younger. But in the men's game, we talk about even now there being a disconnect between the players who've played first-class cricket and the players who've just played white ball cricket, because they don't develop the basis of their batting as much. Do you think your batting would have been better if you'd played a lot more red ball cricket, especially at the top level? Or is that it doesn't matter? It's, you know, it's not even a valid question, because you've gone on the path you've gone.
I think, just from watching a lot of test cricket and thinking about how I best play spin in one day cricket, for example, is I think you learn that by spending time in the middle. But when you're always playing a format of the game where there's scoreboard pressure, you sometimes don't give yourself the opportunity to work through those phases of the game. And so if the ball is turning and for a phase of the game you don't want to play against the spin, and you do that for 20 overs, and then you successfully negate that, and then you bring another shot into your game and you go through the gears. I just think when there's run rate pressure, you sort of don't give yourself that opportunity to play in that nature, which is sometimes required in different conditions. So I just think you're a little bit stunted in your growth of learning about how to play in conditions, because it's kind of fast-tracked. You don't have that time in the middle, and then, you know, scoreboard pressure can off maybe lead to mistakes quicker or failure quicker. Yeah. So you have less time in the middle. And technically, I think with the swinging ball as well, like one day cricket, even 20 over cricket, the ball still swings, and how you negate that. Whereas now it's just around, I guess, hitting out. You know, there's not the talk of how to negate the first 10 overs of the ball swinging and get through that period, which I still think sometimes has its place. But it's hard, because 20 over cricket is where the game is going right now. But I still think young batters and young bowlers, you know, someone mentioned an Australian player who had played a lot of domestic cricket, but she'd never bowled more than 4 overs in a game. You know, so to be able to bowl 10, 15 overs, spinners being able to bowl 30 overs and get a rhythm and learn the length on different tracks, they just don't get those opportunities. And even with limited 50 over cricket and then 20 over cricket, you bowl a different ball every ball, so they never get their stock delivery as good as it could be. Yeah, so I think there are...
It's about rhythm as much as anything, isn't it? It's that ability to have the muscle memory that you are building. You're stopping and starting all the time in limited overs cricket, whereas if you're playing multiple red ball games, you have, you know, a lot more ability to get yourself into that rhythm and get more and feel more comfortable and natural with what you're doing.
Yeah, and patience with the ball, patience with the bat at times. It's not where the game's heading, but I think there's still a place for, you know, being able to just hit top of off over and over again, and not having to change pace or bowl a bouncer. It's if to most players, whenever we do scouting all around the world, it's like comes back to top of off. You know, that's where you bowl.
So you think the women from the countries that still play multi-day cricket and then occasionally test cricket are at an advantage over some of the other players just from in that way then?
Yeah, the fact that they're playing all three formats. And you have someone like Annabel Sutherland, you know, who gets limited opportunities sometimes in the Australian team, but she's able to bat and score 200 in a match. Like the confidence that gives you as an international player. And I just think it's the mental toughness and resilience that comes with test match cricket as well as an advantage. And yeah, it's sort of a bit more of a mental challenge. And so I find it hard when not everyone's playing. Like, I'm so supportive and I love it, but it's sort of when you're in the same, you know, the competition, and you're at the same level, but some people are, it does feel a little bit unfair at times. And that's no one's fault. It's just how you feel when you're missing out, I think.
Yeah. The Annabel Sutherland thing's interesting, because you think about the amount of times she's batted at number 5 or number 6 in franchise tournaments, and she might face, you know, a handful of balls. But then in an international game, she gets to face hundreds and, hundreds of balls in one game. So it's that's what we're talking about. It's that time in the middle that you get access to from that. I want to talk about your batting specifically. I looked up your numbers, and you're much better chasing than you are batting first.
Wow.
And I wondered if there is a reason for that. Does that suit your personality, you know, to understand what the chase is? Is there any reason you think you would be better in that kind of way?
Funny you say that, because I feel like I've batted my best innings when I've batted first, but I obviously don't look at stats that much. I think in 50 over cricket, I've always wanted to score quickly. Whereas when you're chasing, the scoreboard sort of dictates whether you're doing a good job or not. Whereas when you bat first, you sometimes want to push the game forward faster than it perhaps needs to be, or you get caught up in getting a bit carried away. Whereas with chasing, it's like, that's the score, I'm doing my job, just keep doing it until we've won the game. And it's probably that mindset helps me a little bit, especially in 50 over cricket.
So it is interesting, because one day cricket, you are much better at chasing, and in T20 cricket, you're better at batting first. And in one day cricket, you actually score quicker when you're chasing than you do in the first innings. So it's there's something about that. And one of the reasons I want to ask that is that you are a one day specialist, because you don't play test matches. And we see a lot of the best one day players of all time generally are better at chasing than they are in the first innings. So it almost suits the way that they play, the that ability to know what you have to do compared to the blank canvas of the first innings. So, but the fact that it doesn't go over for most for both of yours is quite interesting. The other team that you had the biggest problems with is England. And, you know, Australia's probably the best team you've gone up against consistently in your career. And you've gone up against really good Indian teams as well. But you have a very good record, you know, in Australia and in India and against those teams. But you've struggled more against England. Is that something, you know, for a New Zealand cricketer, generally they do pretty well against England because similar kinds of bowlers swinging it around and everything. Is there particular reasons you think that England bowlers might have caused you any more troubles? Or is it just one of those things?
No, I probably wouldn't have admitted this, but now they've retired, I can. I actually said it on the sideline in the recent series. I said to Georgia Plummer, one of our younger players, I said, I do not miss Catherine Brunt and Anya Srivastava. I just felt like as an opening combination, you know, like they swung the ball away, swung the ball in, and they were just so relentless with their line and lengths, and I just felt there was no let up when I faced them personally. It just felt like every ball, especially as Catherine got older, I felt like when she was a bit younger, you know, she got hit, she tried to go short and bounce you, but as she got older, she, you know, just really held a line and length with a little bit of swing. And I always, the in swing back to her right hand is always a little bit more difficult, but yeah, I think it was those two in particular I just found was the toughest opening combination. And then recently you add Eccleston, a left-arm spinner who's world-class, into the mix as well. Yeah, I just feel with their bowling attack, there was never any let-up. They've always had a very solid 5-6 bowlers and captained very well by Heather Knight, so I have probably found them the toughest bowlers throughout my career. So when I score runs, I feel like I'm in a good place.
It's interesting too, because those are two very different kinds of bowlers. You got one who's sort of more falling away and angling everything back in, swinging it massively. And then, Siva Brunt is quicker, stronger, moving the ball away. So it's almost like the combination was the issue for you as much as anything. Or, you know, was it just they were both really good and they happened to be bowling together?
Well, I think they started with that. And then when the first change came on, there was no let up. And I'm not saying, you know, Australia and India, there necessarily is let up either. It just felt, for whatever reason with them, the next bowler that came on gave you nothing. And I just felt like I had to work so hard for my runs, and they bowled in the areas and set the right fields consistently. And then their spinners came on, and yeah, in 50 over cricket in particular, they'd kind of got themselves ahead of the game through their opening bowlers, and then the spinners could really control that middle phase. And I think we've sometimes played our best cricket against Australia as a team as well, and struggled against England in particular.
The other interesting thing when I was going through your record is that you batted at first drop quite a bit, and it hasn't worked. But it's okay, I'm about to say something nice. Because your record at opening is outstanding, and your overall numbers are dragged down by your numbers when you batted at number three. And you know, I've watched you play, you know, for a long time. I probably first covered you in 2012. So, you know, it's a long time of watching you play. There's something about the way that you bat that I think really suits opening the batting, of setting the tone. And maybe it's that thing we were talking about before of getting on the front foot and putting the pressure on. What was it? What is it about opening that do you think suits your game compared to perhaps batting down the order?
Yeah, I think initially it was just because it was what I knew. So, you know, as first drop, mentally not knowing when you're going out to bat, I think I initially struggled with. Whereas as an opener, you know, win the toss, or you just know when you've got to be on. And I liked that, I guess, you know, it's kind of a plan. So I'm like, I know this is when I'm going to bat. And I think in New Zealand side, as a leader as well, I felt like, yeah, setting the tone kind of suited me as well. That's how I wanted to lead through my actions. So that probably by opening, it was like if I'd face the first ball, you know, it was just the body language, the calling, which I didn't always get right, but I think it's that nature of things. And even now, you know, with 20 over cricket and the power play being so important. It's sort of a senior, we've got a lot of young players in our team. It's like a senior player to like set the tone with the intent. So I feel, yeah, I don't know why that is, but I also think when you're going well, it's the best time to bat. The ball's hard, the field's up. It's exciting. So I've always loved it. And when I don't open, it does feel a little bit foreign. I sort of don't know what to do with myself. I'm sitting there like, whereas when you open and if you're on the sideline, you're out. So you sort of, I can chat to the other players and your job out in the middle is done. Whereas when you're sitting waiting, it's different to when you're an opener.
Did you open at all levels in all formats, red and white ball? Like that was just what you did?
No, I think I batted first drop a lot when I was younger. And my first game for the White Ferns, I batted at 9. And I was picked as a bowler. And then the next game, he just was like, oh, you're going to open with Rebecca Rolls. And I was like, what? Like,
that's quite a promotion.
And like, he was, at the time, like, very clear of how he wanted us to play. It was like when the power play had come in and he wanted us to go really hard in the power play, which seems ridiculous now, but at the time that was so forward thinking. Like people just used to bat the 58, whereas he was like, the power play, we're going to go really hard. And so I was sort of this young fearless cricketer that he wanted me to open and make the most of the power play, and that's what I was kind of told to do. And it suited the way I played at that age as well. So he saw something in me that I don't even think I'd thought about, or other coaches had sort of had me at 3 or 4. It was just the way he wanted to set up the White Ferns at that time for the next World Cup.
So I recently interviewed Barry Richards, who played 4 test matches because of apartheid. So he comes in, he smashes the ball everywhere, then the apartheid separation happens and they don't play test cricket anymore. And obviously, occasionally he plays like World 11s and Kerry Packer series and everything. But I asked him if he thought he got the most out of his batting. And he said no, because I got bored at the level I was playing and I never got to expand my game the way that I wanted to, and it didn't work. Do you think you are, you have got the most out of yourself as a batter without the ability to play test cricket?
I think I've given my all to getting the most out of myself, mm-hmm. and the intent to be the best player I could possibly be. I think any cricketer will look back on their career and feel like at times the mental side or self-doubt has got in the way of, and you've got in your own way at times of getting the best out of yourself. So yeah, physically and in terms of trying to evolve my game, always trying to be the best player I could be, you know, seeing other players around the world and what, you know, it took to be the best batter in the world and wanting to be that, I've given myself the best chance. But I do think sometimes the self-doubt and the mental side of the game gets in the way of really letting yourself do that. And as you get older, you probably understand that so much better, and you look back and you're like, oh, if only at 25, you know, I didn't care so much about the failure and was able to focus on the process for longer and just be more resilient to failure. So, yeah, yes and no, I guess I've answered that question. Still looking for the ultimate player that's within me.
I get asked the question quite a lot of who is the best player who's never played test cricket. And your name comes up a lot. When we have that discussion, you would have grown up. We talked about before you watching the WNBA and the NBA, and that's the elite, you know, level of basketball, and that's kind of, you know, what you wanted. You also would have grown up watching men's test cricket, right? And you know, and also when you were younger, there was New Zealand occasionally played women's test matches, I suppose, back in the day as well. How does it feel to be so good at what you do and one of the best players in the world and so respected as a captain and all these different things, but know that you might end your career without actually playing a test match for your country?
Yeah, like it doesn't feel good. And like you say, I think as an athlete, it doesn't matter what sport you're doing or what gender you are. You know, you watch sport growing up and you're inspired. And as a young kid, you don't think about the barriers of what you can and can't do or what you should and shouldn't do. And for whatever reason, when I was growing up, I never felt like I can't do that. I was like, well, they're doing that, I'm going to do that. And I think that's what I struggle with the test match is I love watching cricket. And when you watch the fifth day of a test match and, you know, they've toiled away and, you know, there's been ups and downs and ebbs and flows, and that team moment when the team wins the fifth day, knowing kind of what they've been through together, I'm really envious of that feeling. And to have played for so long and not been able to experience that with my teammates or as an individual, or batting a whole day and you just being mentally exhausted, I feel like I'm kind of missing out. And and it's even harder now when females play, because, you know, when you watch the men, you're sort of envious without wanting to be them. Whereas I think when the females play, you're a bit like, oh, I wonder what that's like. And yeah, it is a real shame, I think, for any cricket player that hasn't been able to test themselves, for a better word. And and if I don't get the chance, like, I'll get over it and not hold on to it forever. But when I talk about it, like, when I watch it, there are those feelings, and there's a little bit of envy. There's a little bit of wonder of how I'd go, you know, like, if I got out first ball, it'd be a nightmare. I just feel, you know, as a player, you feel like there should be sort of equal opportunities. And for whatever reason in New Zealand, we haven't had that.
Here's my last question. How do you think you would have gone as a test batter?
I think I probably would have been I would have been quite frustrating to watch, because I would have got bored too. You know, I would have played, the first 10 overs and let the ball swing and play straight. And then I would have felt like I could play all my shots in the 15th over and then nicked off and been having to sit and watch. Well, I'd like to think, though, that if I'd played a few more games, that I would have learnt, that I love batting so much that I was just going to bat for days and days. And, I think of someone like Amelia Kerr, and batting with her in a test match would be, as a cricket, nothing. Like, we would have been tragic. If we'd had a all-day partnership, man, the conversation, then we'd talk about it for the rest of our lives. So it's probably a good thing that we haven't had that chance.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's been great chatting.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.